Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to this evening's event. It's a pleasure to see everyone here and also online. This event, as you can see, is called Narratives in Policymaking. And we are anticipating a lively evening with some provocations from the folk here and participation from you. So my name is Sonia Livingstone. I'm a professor of social psychology in the Department of Media and Communications at LSE. And just housekeeping before we kick off to say, please do put your phones on silent because the event is being recorded and will be a podcast. And those who are online can already start asking their questions. Actually, put your names in the Q&A box along with your question and we will come to you. So tonight is to celebrate the launch of the publication of the new LSE Public Policy Review issue on narratives in policymaking. And I believe there's a QR code, just as I mention it. So the LSE Public Policy Review is a new open access journal by LSE Press. It publishes a range of thematic issues from different disciplinary perspectives, including recently populism, well-being, tax justice, AI, the war in Ukraine, and more. And the new special issue that we're here to launch and to celebrate explores how personal and social narratives shape policymaking in a variety of ways. So everyone loves stories, we're all storytellers, but how does telling stories affect what we decide is important? How does it influence that decision making? How do stories enter into the way in which policies are understood, implemented and evaluated? The papers in the collection from different disciplines, they draw on different methods and they show why narratives matter. And that might not be the most obvious point from the start, but really I think this is a recognition of the importance of stories from research, from policy, and as they affect issues from politics, EU cohesion, community mediation, and even space policy. So you have the QR code there. So we're going to hear from three speakers and one respondent, and their names have now gone, so I will give you their bios. So we're going to hear first from Paul Dolan, who is Professor of Behavioural Science here at LSE. He's author of Happiness by Design, Happy Ever After. I don't think there should be a book after that, really. But after that comes Beliefism, How to Stop Hating the People That We Disagree With. And Paul is the academic lead of the Narratives in Policymaking project and guest editor of the issue. We will then hear from Sarah Dillon, who is Professor of Literature and Public Humanities at the University of Cambridge. She was director of the Cambridge Doctoral Training Partnership, program director at the Leverhulme Centre for the Future of Intelligence, and chair of the British Association for Contemporary Literary Studies. And she co-authored a book, Story Listening, which she is holding.
I brought a prop.
Subtitle Narrative Evidence and Public Reasoning with Claire Craig, and she'll be talking, I think, about the book. Adam Brzezinski is a British Academy postdoctoral fellow at the Suntory and Toyota International Centres for Economics and Related Disciplines here at LSE. He has a project on the political economy of narratives, and his research has addressed the role of narratives in relation to climate change policy, the success and failure of pro-market narratives, and how science-sceptic narratives impeded the effectiveness of the COVID-19 policies. And finally, we are delighted to have with us to discuss the policy implications arising from these papers, Dame Sharon White, who is a member of the House of Lords and who has served more than 15 years in the UK public service, including having served as the Chief Executive of the Office of Communications, Ofcom, which is the UK's media, telecoms and postal regulator. She was Executive Chairman of the John Lewis Partnership and is a senior managing editor and head of global affairs at LACAS, as well as being a visiting professor in practice at the LSE School of Public Policy. So each is going to speak for about 5 minutes, and then we will see if the conversation takes off here or we will bring you in, so be ready with your thoughts. I'm going to ask Paul to kick us off.
Thank you very much, Sonia. Good evening, everybody. So I wrote a book called Happiness by Design about a decade ago. It was the first of three books, but I've suffered a lot from first album syndrome. I've actually written much better work since, but everyone wants to hear tracks from the first album. And in that book, I tell a story of my wife's best friend. She's still my wife's best friend. About us going to dinner and her complaining the whole of the time we were at dinner, for 2 hours or more, felt like 2 weeks, about every single aspect of her job. Her commute, her boss, her colleagues, how painful working at, we're being recorded for a podcast, Medialand, it's a three-letter broadcasting company in the UK. and then we left dinner, and she stood up and she thought for a moment, she said, "Do you know what? I love working at Medialand." And she wasn't being ironic, she was just accessing different conceptions of what it meant to have a good job. On the first hand, her experiences every day were miserable, but the narrative that she told about her job was that it was somewhere she'd always wanted to work, her parents were proud, her friends were jealous. How could she not be happy working at Medialand? And that actually became, it's only a very small part of the book, but the New Statesman quote on the paperback is, "The book that will make you quit your job." It's not quite the best sales pitch. Anyway, and it interested me then, due to other things as well, but in the role that narratives play in our lives and in the lives that we think we should be leading. So I wrote my second book, which was all the way up to publication. There's no one from Penguin here, is there? Well, they can hear it on the podcast. Right the way up to publication, it was called The Narrative Trap. And I allowed Penguin to persuade me to put happy in the title, because Happiness by Design did so well. They wanted the happiness professor again. So it had happy in the title, but it is The Narrative Trap. And it's a book about the stories that we're told, the social narratives, about the lives that we ought to lead, that often get in the way with us leading the most authentic and happy lives in the absence of those stories. And so the chapter that I have in the special issue, along with the editorial at the beginning, is really focusing on the reaching related narratives about how you can never really have enough money, success, or education. And how actually, in fact, all of us know, but it doesn't tell such a good story, that everything is dose response. Everything is about dose. If I were to put any quantity on the x-axis on the y-axis, I always get those two wrong, the horizontal, and then the intensity on the vertical, nothing in life would ever be categorically always increasing or always decreasing. There'd be a U-shape or an inverted U. And the same applies unequivocally, we think, from the data. Of course, there's no randomised controlled trials around those factors, particularly income, success and education. It would be lovely if there was. But inferences made from quasi-causal studies suggesting that there's a sweet spot for all of those things. The sweet spot depends on a whole range of factors. We could discuss those more fully if we had time, if this were a talk about that chapter. The point, the substantive point, is that the narratives around income, success and education become so powerful that they become addicted, that you can never have enough of any of these dimensions. I should say that there might be diminishing returns even to education. I know it's a bit weird saying that at the LSE as a professor, but you might want to think about whether it's worth doing a PhD. Anyway, no, it's correlational. Miserable people start off doing PhDs in the first place.
Do they get any happier?
So they absolutely do not, especially if they're supervised by LSE faculty. No. So the point that then to go on and make in the chapter, in the book and elsewhere, is that we need a much more nuanced and ambivalent approach to things. But ambivalence is hard. It doesn't tell a good story. There's moral certitude in asserting something with authority, that you know the answer to something, and saying, well, it depends, or it's about dose response, doesn't have the same gravitas as a story does. And so sometimes those stories can get in the way of us leading happier, healthier, better lives. There are other quite pernicious narratives that we tell, like, if you work hard, you will succeed. Well, as anybody who is successful or otherwise knows, luck plays an enormous part. I'm talking proper randomness, not when you say you make your own luck, because you can't make randomness, much as you might think you can, because luck has no agency, so it's not a good story. We like agency. We like all of our narratives to have coherent structure and agency. How long have I got? Am I almost done? I think I'm nearly there.
Two minutes.
Where shall I go with that? I'm gonna suggest that we stop fetishizing growth, but not degrowth. Again, everything's about balance. That's madness. But growth at all costs is madness. So again, we need to be a bit more balanced. Stop fetishizing social mobility. Actually, social mobility is fine. We don't actually mean social mobility. We mean occupational mobility. We mean getting more working class kids to go into higher education, higher income jobs that often won't make them any happier, that will mean that they lose a lot of the social contact that they might otherwise have had. If it was genuinely social mobility, then I think we'd be on to something better. Education, it's an interesting one. Sharon and I were talking about this on the way in. We have, it's a very nice narrative that education is the root out of poverty. It's not always been shown to be the case. Education often benefits middle-class people better than more than working-class people. The economic returns to higher education in some data increase as you go up the income ladder. And we need to actually also, much as it feels uncomfortable to some of us, myself included actually, we need to consider some of the other routes out of poverty. Family structure is a really important part played. Every bit as important as education. And so the stories are powerful. They help provide structure and coherence to our lives, but they can sometimes get in the way of us leading good lives. And that what that ultimately means, and then I will conclude, because I feel like I'm such a bad advert. I should have bought my book as well. You bought yours. I didn't actually bring it. Beliefism is entirely predicated on the idea, well, the anti-beliefism, on the idea that well-functioning societies celebrate difference. I did actually say in the book originally, well-functioning societies tolerate difference. That's actually not enough. Well-functioning societies celebrate difference. We would never have evolved to be here today in the way that we are if we were all the same. Take any single dimension, risk, attitude. Well, if we were all risk-seeking, we'd all be dead. If we were all cautious, we would never have left Africa. You need a balance of people with different risk appetites. So we need a balance of people with different perspectives and with different stories. And so I think my concluding point, for now at least, will be that we love the power of a story. Let's be a bit more circumspect about how powerful some of those narratives are, particularly ones that give us moral certitude, and accept the fact that other people might have a different story to tell, both in their individual lives and in public policy.
Thank you very much, Paul. My head is now full of stories, I realise, that I have been told, and perhaps also that I tell, and maybe that's how everyone else is feeling. I'm going to pass to Sarah, who is going to tell us perhaps about listening to stories as well as telling them.
Indeed. So I'm going to knuckle down into narratives and policy making in particular, and the question of the relationship between narratives or stories, and I do use the terms synonymously, although whether they are synonymous might be something we want to talk about, is actually not a new question. It goes at least as far back as antiquity to Socrates' discussion of the place of stories in the ideal state in the Republic. And that was about 2,500 years ago, and we're still sitting here trying to figure it out now. So it's obviously a thorny problem. I am a professor of literature, but I'm also within literary studies what one might call a narratologist, and yes, that is a thing, and a structuralist. I like breaking things down into categories and frameworks, so I'm going to offer you some frameworks to think with in the next 5 minutes. And the first distinction I want to make is between storytelling, often considered within policymaking to be associated with persuasion, and story listening, which I want you to start thinking about in relation to informing. And obviously any binary that you set up is going to have its limits, but they can be useful to think with. You'll all no doubt be more familiar with the first one, with storytelling and with persuasion. There is massive amounts of work across disciplines, oddly not in literary studies, across disciplines like psychology, business, marketing, sociology, looking at how stories function as what we might think of as weapons of mass persuasion. They persuade on an individual level, they persuade on a collective level, and they can be wielded in that capacity. I'm not going to give too many specific examples, but I'm sure everyone can think of examples from recent politics in which stories have been used in that way, from the stories told running up to the Brexit referendum, or a master wielder of stories that we have at the head of a nation across the water at the moment. So storytelling to persuade might be, I think, more located within politics than policy, and I think that distinction is an important one. Storytelling, though, does have a role in policy. There have been a lot of people working on what's called the narrative policy framework, for instance, which is a structure designed to enable people who produce knowledge and evidence that might not be originally storied, so we might say scientists, to narrativize, and steal Mary Morgan's word from our previous conversation, that knowledge and evidence to make it more comprehensible, amenable, useful to policymakers. But that also comes with a risk. Studies, for instance, of scientists who've told stories about climate science have actually shown that what happens is if the people disagree with the policies based on those stories, then they start to distrust the scientific evidence behind them. So storytelling of scientific evidence has its risks. And actually, for that reason, in 2020, in a Nature comment piece, statistician David Spiegelhalter, who sort of shot to fame during the pandemic because he was brilliant at telling stories about the data, he and his team published a piece that was sort of channeling their inner Socrates. They wanted to excise stories from the policy evidence ecosystem because they were dangerous, because they were slippery, because they were persuasive, and they wanted to get rid of them because of that, just like Socrates did as well, actually. But I think in doing so, what they have missed is the analytic, the cognitive, the evidential usefulness of stories. In short stories, as far as I understand them, and that's why I've devoted my professional life to studying them, are a way of understanding the world. They're another valid form of sense-making and understanding. And just as a little example, Albert Camus' novel, The Plague, shot to the top of the bestseller list during the pandemic. That's not because people were reading to escape reality. They were reading a novel about the pandemic. They were reading it because they were trying to understand their current reality, and they were turning to stories in order to try and help them do that. So what happened is that on a very rainy day in a basement in Cambridge, I met Claire Craig, who was then the Director of Science Policy at the Royal Society, had worked in government for a long career, and she was increasingly frustrated that all forms of evidence were being taken into account in policymaking, and there were rigorous structures to ensure they were taken into account carefully, and that the evidence was weighed, but then someone would tell a story, and suddenly decisions would be made, and that storytelling was not regulated. There was no framework within policy for story listening and for doing it carefully and rigorously. So that's what we created in Story Listening, which was published back in autumn 2021 now. And so I'll just close by sort of giving you a little bit of a snapshot of what's in Story Listening. What we do is make the case for stories as having cognitive value. So making the case that stories are not just affective, but they're cognitive. They help us understand things. And then for offering four functions of stories that can help inform policy. One of those functions is offering new framings of policy relevant issues. So if you gather a synthesis of stories on a policy issue, you can start to see it from different angles. Some of those angles will be false, but actually thinking about where those stories are coming from can still be useful. So new points of view, looking for dominant or neglected framings that stories might give you access to. And the second function is to do with these collective identities. Stories are important for the way in which they model collective identities within them, but stories are shared. They become social objects that are passed around. The way in which stories move between people, the way in which adherence or belief in certain stories create collective identities that might not correspond to traditional demographic breakdowns can be really helpful in starting to map and understand the collective identities relevant to a particular policy issue. Stories can also act as models. We know already that they play a role within other kinds of models, but narrative models, novels, films, curated textual stories can provide us models of the world that we can that can sometimes model complexity and social factors that perhaps other forms of evidence or knowledge can't model. So the best example I could give of this is Kim Stanley Robinson's novel, The Ministry for the Future, as a result of which he was invited to COP26 in Glasgow. So it's the most incredible model of an anticipatory pathway through to coming to terms with climate change. And that leads me into my final function. Within future studies, narratives have always had a place, backcasting, forecasting, all sorts of narrative futures methods as a way of offering different ways of anticipating the future. And I think stories are more welcome in that context because actually we can't know the future. We can't know it. We try to, but we can't know the future. So there's a sort of openness to the anticipatory function of stories within that context. And Kenneth Boulding, who was an economist, he wrote a foreword to a book called The Image of the Future back in 1973, where he rightly noted that all decisions are about the future, and policymaking is about decision making. So the image of the future, he says, is key to all choice-oriented behaviour. And stories, particularly the history of speculative fiction and science fiction, offer a massive data set of anticipations about the future that can prove really helpful when engaged with critically and rigorously by narrative experts who understand the tools that you need in order to make sense of stories. So those narrative experts exist. We are in English departments across the country. We are in other kinds of humanities departments. We have tools for engaging with story and with narrative. It's on us a little bit that we haven't brought those out into the world enough. I hope we will. The case has been made for story listening in theory. It's being picked up in academic literature. It's being picked up by think tanks, border policy institutions. Their task now is how to embed it within the structures of policymaking and evidence gathering that we already have within this country to start with.
Thank you.
I mean, you better not clap Adam, though.
Adam, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So in my work and in the piece that I co-wrote for the LSEPPR piece, I focus on the political level of narratives. So I focus on the narratives voiced by politicians. And this consists really of two parts. The first part is to try to understand how narratives work in theory. So what are the incentives of politicians to say, to voice the narratives that they do voice? And when you think about it deeply, it actually becomes quite complicated. Because, of course, at first glance, you might think that ideally, politicians just believe in a policy, and then they try to find the best narrative for that policy in order to persuade their voters and the electorate of it. But, of course, politicians also want to be re-elected, so politicians as well try to find narratives that work in the sense that people want to elect them again. And there's a potential tension here because often the policy for which you find the best narrative that gets you re-elected might not be the narrative that actually is good for the country. So studying these tensions is very important in understanding how narratives work on a political level. So that's the first part of the work. The second part is trying to examine narratives in the wild, as it were. So here, in various projects, I study the narratives that politicians actually voice when speaking about different topics, be that climate change or the optimal size of government, so should government be big or small, or immigration or any other topic. And here, what really transformed my work completely over the last few years was the advent of AI. And we hear a lot of negative potential aspects of AI. So let me give you one positive aspect, which is that I think that we are today in a better position than perhaps ever to study political narratives at scale by using AI, and in particular large language models. So that doesn't mean at all that AI is perfect. Of course not. It's no silver bullet. It won't capture all the nuance of narratives that we want to capture in political speeches. But it can do so much more, and we can do so much more than we were used to do, than we were used to be able to do even as recently as 2 or 3 years ago. So just to give you sort of a glimpse of the sort of things we can do now, based on my own research, I'll give you two examples, actually. So in one project, we studied climate policy narratives in the EU, trying to understand how politicians voice, what kind of narratives politicians voice in the EU about the need for climate policy and how this has been changing. And with the use of LLMs, or large language models, these AI tools that are now prevalent, we were able to analyze all speeches made in the EU by politicians in the parliament, in the 9th European Parliament, so that's between 2019 and 2024. That's 45,000 speeches. And we were able to analyze each one individually to try to draw out the sort of climate narratives that politicians voiced. And we found that, perhaps unsurprisingly to us now, that there was a big narrative shift over the past few years, and politicians became much more likely to voice climate skeptic narratives in parliament, saying that climate policy is actually not needed. Much more likely to do so now than even 3-4 years ago. But we aren't only able to say that this happened. We are also able to quantify to some extent, and we are able to pinpoint how these changes happened differentially across different parties. So I think that's a way in which we can use large language models to understand narratives, which, you know, we couldn't have done as recently as perhaps 3 years ago. And as my second example, which is the example that I discuss in the piece for the LC Public Policy Review, we look at one of the most prevalent debates in politics, perhaps, which is the optimal size of government. So should government be large, have a lot of taxes and a lot of spending, or should it be small? So sort of lean and efficient. And what we were able to do with these new tools is to look at all speeches made in the UK House of Commons since 1950. So in total, that's, I think, 4 million speeches. So you can imagine how impossible it is to approach this task without quite advanced tools. So for now, we did a subset of the analysis, looking at maybe 10% of speeches. And we found that today seems to be quite a unique time period for British politics when it comes to debates about the size of government. In particular, the last 10 years or so look very different to everything since World War II, in a sense that from our analysis as it stands at the moment, it seems that the Conservative Party and the Labour Party have actually moved quite close to each other when it comes to the optimal size of speeches about the optimal size of government. Where in recent years, if you look at all the speeches made by Conservative MPs, they have been moving more and more towards big government, supporting big government speeches, in particular because they speak more and more about health, and this has become a really big topic. So this is maybe not conclusive yet, and we do need to do more work, but this just shows that we can really look at a huge amount of evidence right now with these imperfect but still very valuable tools to draw insights about narratives and policymaking that I don't think we could have done a few years ago. So yeah, I think it's a very exciting time to study narratives.
Thank you. Thank you. Lots and lots of data. Nothing makes the academic happier.
Put that in your book, Paul.
So, Sharon, you have lots of experience of policymaking across very different sectors, actually. And I'm wondering how you would like to reflect on these provocations and the role of narrative within it.
Thank you very much indeed. There's no book. But I wanted, first of all, thank you so much for allowing me as the sort of non-academic to be sort of part of the panel, part of the discussion. I spent about 35 years working on kind of different aspects of policy, and I think never has the question of narrative and how narrative is linked to impactful policy been more important. In August and September 2016, I have a very sort of nerdy, he's 21 years old today, but he was 11 at the time, I have a very, very nerdy older son. And after the Brexit vote, we watched almost every presidential debate. So my son doesn't play football, he doesn't read, so just go figure. And at the end of the debate, so this was obviously Hillary Clinton and now President Trump, I said to him, you know, so darling, who would you vote for and why? And he said, well, I think I'd vote for Hillary, but I'm not quite sure what she would do. And I don't really like Trump, Mummy, but he's going to build a wall. And, I mean, there was something slightly sort of terrifying from an 11-year-old, but I think has some really quite profound consequences for policy. And I wanted to point to four quick examples which sort of pick up on some of the themes that we've had already this evening. Two examples that I would say are... this is from a UK context, so apologies, because I know we'll have sort of lots of international kind of views and voices in the room. Two examples of what I would call great narrative that is really closely aligned with evidence and analytics, and two examples that I would say are still current and go beyond the UK of where... I guess that comes to your point, Adam, where the storytelling almost itself prevents good policy. And I'll be kind of super brief so we can get to the conversation. The first relates to 1997, which is when the Labour government came in the UK. Some of you will know or have read about this. This is Tony Blair as Prime Minister, having been out of government since 1979, so a lot of time to have extended therapy sessions and sort of reflect on why they had lost. And if you think back to that time, the defining sort of mission of the government, we've talked about education, was education, education, education. And in some ways, it was a very flip narrative. What are your priorities? They're education, education, education. But actually, it was based on 5 to 6 years of analytical work and evidence about what drove stronger outcomes, particularly for communities from poorer backgrounds, and was linked most critically to practical policy that was then implemented. So both early years supporting Sure Start, early years centres, the shift to smaller class sizes for primary schools, the end of subsidies for kids going into private schools. So you had a line that I think if you ask anybody about that period who lived through it will remember, but actually it was tied to two or three practical policies from an evidence base that then had impact. The second, probably more controversially, the only coalition government we have had in peacetime in 2010, which was a coalition between the Conservative Right of Centre Party and the Liberal Democrats, and actually in Adam's mind they probably converged in terms of their view about the size of government, which was the period of austerity after the financial crisis. And again, the narrative, which was the failure, in their words, of the previous government to fix the roof when the sun was shining, was both a diagnosis of the failure, perceived failure of the previous government, but also a signal of their permission, then rightly or wrongly, to basically shrink the size of the state. And so again, you had a compelling, as I say, whether you agree or disagree, but you had a compelling narrative, which then had some very, very profound implications, which I think we're probably still seeing today in terms of some of the cutbacks in the size and the role of the state. Education, education, education. Why did those guys not fix the roof when the sun was shining? And then I would sort of point to two examples where I think we continue to have a failure of sort of narrative and policy. The one is, I'm an economist by background. I was never a very good economist. I did the maths LSE course about 100 years ago. And so economists talk about GDP, and we talk about growth, and we talk about inflation and not prices and not affordability. And we talk in words and macro terms that do not and continue to not touch emotionally or practically on most of the population, most of the people paying taxes, most of the people who are part of our society. Why aren't you more grateful that inflation is 2% when actually my grocery bill has gone up by 30% over the last 5 years? Why are you not enjoying growth now at, well, let's talk about the States, 4.4% when my community is not benefiting? So we use words and terms in a macro level, which I think is profoundly causing, accelerating, aggravating the dislocation actually between our politicians. Adam talked about this in the public. And very lastly, criminal justice. I don't know if anybody's worked in the criminal justice system, but basically it is now almost impossible to do evidence-based reform in criminal justice because of stories. Why can't we move away from jury trials, because these are a firmament of the British system, even though rape trials are taking 7 years and collapse because of the queues in the system? Why are some types of murder getting longer sentences than others because they're all based on individuals and stories? Why is the age of criminal responsibility in the UK at 10 because no politician's prepared to stand up and make the argument? So we've got some fantastic examples of great storytelling, evidence, analysis and policy impact, and I think we continue to live with the implications of not being able to integrate a narrative and policy, particularly on criminal justice and particularly on the big issues of equality and growth.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So now I think we probably have lots to say. Paul is going to come right. I just want to say to people online, I have got a tablet in front of me. I can see if you ask questions and I will bring them in. But thank you, Paul. Go for it.
So that was brilliant. Almost brilliant. There was one tiny bit that I just want to reaffirm what I said about dose. Because the education narrative, absolutely right. Early years, Sure Start, all those programs. But it became emboldened into all forms of education across all ages. If you take educational maintenance allowance, there's some really cool data suggesting now, if you look at LEO data, which is HMRC tax return data, that some of those kids that were in EMA would have been better off getting jobs, getting apprenticeships and learning trades and skills rather than staying in education. And that's the problem, is that it become, we start off on the right track. And it's a really interesting question. I think that's, you know, as much back at you, Sam, really, is like, how do you get off the train that leads you, you know, because it's worked so far. I mean, we want more and more and more of it, to the point at which there are things we do, like EMA, which were actually probably, on balance, harmful
Yeah, I mean, I probably have the sort of... I mean, it's a great point. I also have probably now the counter view, which is our issue today is less about the state, in a sense, over-delivering than it is about the state under-delivering. So Paul's point, which is essentially, are there too many people staying in education? Are the proportion of people going into higher education a mistake funded by tuition fees? I think that's a great conversation to have. It's not something I worry about as profoundly as the fact that we have got a failing further education system, for example, because the policymakers and politicians, kids, are not part of that world and can't tell stories and get an emotional connection because they're in a different bubble.
So I think something is emerging about the relation between stories and evidence that I just want to kind of tease out. So I think, Sharon, you gave two very powerful examples of where the story actually flies in the face of the evidence. It means we can't hear the evidence because these stories are compelling, as Adam also told us. They kind of win in the political sphere. Sarah, you began with something along those lines, you and your co-author arguing about why those of us in the research world are kind of doing all these systematic evidence reviews and yet a story can kind of crush them. And I think you ended by convincing us all that the story is always right.
No, not at all. So, no, I hope I didn't do that.
It was a compelling case for the power. So you're the structuralist. I mean, how do we tell the good stories from
I don't. I'm not interested in telling stories.
Okay.
In this context. My family would probably disagree around the dinner table. I'm interested in not how stories connect to evidence derived from other sources. Mm-hmm. I want us to realise that stories are themselves a form of evidence. Mm-hmm. So your speeches that you're looking at, they're telling stories. That's evidence. That's evidence of political narratives around climate change that needs to be taken into account alongside scientific evidence, alongside macroeconomic evidence. And we miss out on a really important way of understanding the world if we only think of stories as a way of mediating or translating or communicating other types of evidence. So it's not that the story is right, it's that stories are data, stories are evidence, stories are information, and we need a rigorous way of understanding that to feed it into a pluralistic evidence base on any particular policy issue. So and we have had to say that we've repeated this so many times, and it is a really alien concept for people in this sphere because stories are so often only thought about in terms of storytelling.
And I think there are different disciplinary perspectives then, and I'm curious how the different disciplines in the special issue kind of speak to that. I mean, so anthropologists or historians or often psychologists tell stories from below. You know, they are keen to hear the stories being told, the experiences of people who are living through. Economists, I defer to Sharon here, perhaps don't tell so many stories. It's much more the statistics, the generality, the representative sample. And are you a political scientist?
I would identify myself as a political economist.
Okay. Well, then, yes.
So I think that's only a story.
Yeah, these are all stories. So the different disciplines have kind of different sympathy, perhaps.
Yeah, but the anthropologists, they're not telling stories. They're listening to stories.
Yes, yes.
And then they are processing those stories in order to provide knowledge about, for instance, the group or the collective identity that they're looking at.
Yes.
So may I ask, have your ideas gained any traction with members of parliament? Because you might think that that is exactly one of their jobs, to sort of talk to their constituents and to draw from the stories that they tell them. Policy conclusions, they should have been, I imagine they are easier constituency for you than perhaps bureaucrats who deal with GP and...
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. We talk about in the paper in the special issue about how difficult it is to move theories or concepts from academia into practice. And this is seen across the board. So that's sort of the next step we're at with the work. We haven't done it, but it was very interesting to see the COVID inquiry open up to stories and to request what we would call oral narratives from people who had experienced it. We missed a trick there in the sense that they should have been using story listening to then process those narratives. I don't know what they've done with them. I don't know who they've got working on them. I don't know which narrative experts they've employed. It's great that they've been collected, but unless they are processed with the necessary expertise to synthesize and distill the information they're providing, it's a token gesture that everybody just feels like they've been able to tell their story and have their say. So we've still got a lot more work to do, is the answer to that question.
I think Adam might do it with his AI in 5 minutes. It might not take so long.
Well, not to be too much of a sort of a seller of AI, but I do think that, especially when it comes to story listening, I mean, it used to be the case that the only way that you can ask people about their opinions at scale is to have surveys. And then you cross, you know, on a Likert scale, how much do you agree or disagree with this from one to seven? Or, you know, do you believe this or do you believe that? And everything is pre-written. There is very, very little wiggle room for people to express what they actually think if they weren't given all these constraints on how to think. Whereas now you can set up chatbots and the chatbot can ask open questions and then people can answer whatever they want to answer. They don't even have to type it, they can speak it. And people actually at LSE are working on how to optimally design such sort of new ways of serving people, which are much more interactive. So this might be a good source for your story listening.
I think we should do some work.
Sharon?
I was really interested in Sarah's point about storytelling being a source of evidence. And I think there's a real sort of genius point in this, because actually when the politicians and the, what are we, bureaucrats? I was a bureaucrat. The politicians.
We call you practitioners.
Practitioners. Politicians and practitioners come together. Because you want the storytelling, but you also don't want to do policy by what we would call by anecdote.
Yes.
And nor do you want to have a sort of beautifully designed policy that can't then be explained and held by the public or the taxpayers. And so I think there's something really interesting about not... You're sort of getting rid of the dangers that practitioners feel. The sort of the story drives the policy, or the storytelling is just spin and propaganda about the policy.
Yeah.
So how does the storytelling become a piece of evidence as you're bringing together policy that has an impact on real people's lives, but also that has an emotional connection?
And can some kinds of experience not so readily be translated into stories? I'm thinking of Paul's effort to recognise those for whom it depends, for whom it's complex, for who, you know, it doesn't get summarised in a single and perhaps extreme experience. Some experiences are hard to tell as compelling stories. I'm thinking, I think that's what you were saying, Paul, about the kind of complexity of... Sometimes it just depends, and we have, you know, we're looking for a balance, and that doesn't make for the best story.
Yeah, maybe. Can I just first of all say on the interdisciplinarity, it's one of the great things about doing these special issues is you get different disciplines to contribute on a topic. And I should thank Irene for helping me, you know, get everyone involved in the way that we have. She can't be here this evening. So that's good. So go and read the papers. On the complexity, so our brains are wired for simplicity. They don't want to expend effort and energy. We want to conserve attention or resources. So simple, compelling stories have enormous resonance and power, and particularly magnified by our interactions online. If you say, for example, during COVID, which is an example that's been brought up, we should be proportionately balancing costs and benefits. An eminently sensible thing to say. It's not particularly exciting. every death is a tragedy, which is of course an absurd and empty statement, has moral certitude and power to it. So my challenge is to, where do we design environments? Because we're not going to do it by willpower. We're not going to will ourselves more ambivalent. We're not going to will ourselves more complicated and confused. How do we design environments, organise our lives, organise our institutions and our workplaces in ways that build in ambivalence? And there are some ways in which we can do that. Danny Kahneman, who some of you may be familiar with, author of Thinking Fast and Slow, he wasn't the first to coin this phrase. No, sorry, he was the first to coin this phrase, but not the first to use the approach. Adversarial collaboration, which is basically where you bring together academics who explicitly disagree. Because one of the things that economists are not very good at understanding is that everybody has priors and prejudices and beliefs that they bring to a challenge, even economists who think they look objectively at data. None of us can ever do that. We can never be free, even if those biases aren't conscious, they're unconscious. And so creating an environment that honestly recognises and accepts those different perspectives that go into the research question, that then hopefully you might get some research findings that you can potentially agree about. Even then, you know, Danny was not very optimistic about people changing their minds about anything, because we have a significant degree of hindsight wisdom. After the fact, I can always tell you how the experiment should have been done better. But it makes us humble, and it introduces humility into the process. And I think that's the point I wanted to, on my stream of consciousness, finish with for now, is humility. I think that's the fundamental requirement of us to engage with different stories, with complicated stories, and actually with stories that sometimes absolutely work for some people and work in some policy settings and some policy environments, but other times don't.
Can I come in on that one, which I think is less about what kind of experiences can't be narrativized and more about which stories we listen to and which ones we don't hear. So we talk about dominant narratives and less dominant narratives, and it is too easy for dominant narratives to be the only ones that are heard and the only ones that then inform decision making. So one of the things we did is, even if we haven't quite got story listening into practitioners yet, we did a couple of practical exercises. And one was on space policy, not this kind of space with a big S there. And one of the dominant narratives about space that we hear all the time, particularly from Elon Musk-y type people, is this kind of escape narrative, you know, that we can just kind of, when we've used up Earth, we can just go somewhere else and start again with all of our same extractive practices that we have used here. What we don't hear, for instance, is narratives from communities that are already being affected in detrimental ways by space programs, whose land has been occupied for testing sites, whose relationship with dark skies has been polluted because of the amount of space debris and orbits we have, things we have in orbit now. And so one of the points of story listening, one of the many points, is let's make sure we listen to a whole range of different stories, not just the dominant narratives, and then we can factor those and often the communities that they represent into decision making better.
I've noticed that one of the things that's happening in policy making right now is politicians are calling for a national conversation. And I've been thinking about that idea that there should be more conversation, informal deliberation almost, rather than speechifying and talking past each other. So there's one going on right now about whether we should ban children from the digital world, which I'm paying a lot of attention to.
You've got a book on it, haven't you?
Coming. Trouble is, yes, it's coming, whenever I get time to write. So hands up are welcome, and okay, we have a number, so I might take them in groups and let people have a chance to respond. So I'm going to take the three I see in the centre of the centre at the moment, if I may. I'm beginning with a woman in red, lying in the middle of the room, and a man in grey behind her.
If you just want to say your name and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Denise Mitchell. Thank you so much for being here this evening. So my question is about the future of narratives and policymaking, given two dynamics that we currently have going on. So one, we have this era of hyper-individualism, where people are increasingly isolated, focused on themselves, not really cohabitating or procreating, and so more of a me focus and less of an interest in other people's lives, seemingly. We also have, I would say, an oversaturation of narratives via social media, so you can't really open an app without someone telling you a short story the long way. I'm usually trying to sell something, but you're bombarded constantly with podcasts and posts and videos, so you're always hearing narratives. So how do those two binaries, if you will, take shape in the future for creating policy?
Very good, thank you. And speaks also to that question of future, yes. And then just behind?
Michael Blanning, LSE alumni, a long time ago. Take a narrative. Welfare spending is out of control and needs to be cut. Or tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. You could argue that only a Labour government could deliver those narratives successfully or create impact. How do you see the insignificance of the importance of the ethos of the messenger in affecting the impact of the logos of the message?
So who says it? Thank you. And with a red scarf. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, thank you for the brilliant talks. I'm Bettina Friedrich from UCL. I want to follow up on a point that has been mentioned by Professor Sarah Dillon, the thing about who is actually creating the narratives that policies are for. I think it's this sentence, like, nothing about us without us, is incredibly important. So I'm a researcher really interested in health equity, but unfortunately every panel discussion I attend about health equality or health equity is usually led by people with very privileged accents. And I always feel, where are the people whose voices really matter, because the policies are about them? And I'm just wondering, how can this be addressed more? Because I think this is one of the main issues we have in this country, that the people who should be fostered and helped don't really get a voice in creating the policies, and their narratives should really matter because it's about them. Thank you very much.
There's a theme of equity running through these different questions, I think. Who gets to tell the stories? Whose stories do or don't get heard? And Paul is looking like
well,
he wants to take first
go. Well, with the least posh accent in the world, for those of you who may not be English, my accent is not posh. I come from the East End of London, and I've kept most of my accent, although my friends still think I'm posh. So it actually does matter. Voices literally matter. And one of the things that education does, by and large, not for everybody all of the time, is cleanse people of their backgrounds, so that you essentially end up joining a club because you face the choice of either fitting in or leaving. I have another alliteration that's better than that. With the messenger, I think that's a super, super question. If maybe I'll just deal with that and then allow others to come to other points. When at the time of the coalition government, actually, when the Behaviour Insights team was being set up, we wrote a report called Mindspace, which is a 9-letter mnemonic as essentially a checklist of the behavioural science interventions that are most effective in changing behaviour. And the M of Mindspace is messenger. The messenger is so much more powerful than the message. You listen to a messenger that has authority, that you trust, and ideally has similarity. That's actually often missing. That's the hardest dimension. But if you find somebody, a voice that has authority, trust, and similarity, you can sell pretty much, in every sense of that word, the message. And so that's I think it's incumbent, really, if you're going to think about how to create powerful stories, it's not just the story, it's the story listening, the storytelling, but the messenger that delivers the message is going to be fundamentally important to impacting in whatever way you might want to do that.
Could I pick up on the message? So just to pick up on the messenger point as well, Michael, I think what's interesting about both examples that you give, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, welfare out of control, work is the best form of welfare, is that they are not conventional left of centre messages from a Labour government. they are effectively centrist, arguably right of centre messages, because you are basically, it's the classic sort of third way of trying to triangulate an attack on inequality, but also safety, an attack on poverty, but also a recognition of the burden on taxpayers. And I think to do that credibly is a very unusual, very atypical, I think was very much, I worked for Tony Blair in 97 to 99, I think was very specific to having a very unusual leader of the Labour Party at that time.
Adam, you thought you might want to say something about the question about the oversaturation of narratives. I think you began your remarks by saying something about never have there been so many stories now when looking historically across the last 70 years.
Yeah. So I do have something to say about the question about the future of narratives and the impact on policy. But I think to understand how in the future narratives might change and policy might change, we should think briefly about the present and how incentives are structured in the present between politicians and voters, because there is a big asymmetry. So politicians, they need to craft narratives in order to stay in power and in order to get the policy done that they want. Whereas voters, for many, many voters, political narratives play a very small part of their lives. Of course, probably not for the people who sit here or who study at LSE, but usually just political narratives, they might be one of 10 reels or fewer that people see. So then you have to think about the incentives that voters have to fact check every narrative, right? I think that understanding these incentives is really important, because really, it is extremely complicated to fact-check almost any statement about how policy affects outcomes, be it how does immigration affect wages or how does trade affect whatever you want. It's just almost impossible. Academics, economists disagree about this all the time, so for any voter to try to look into it and make sense of it is almost nearly impossible task. At the same time, the incentives are almost not there for voters to get it right. Right. So I think this is the first starting point to understand that because there is little incentive for any individual voter to fact check everything, whereas there is a huge incentive for politicians to try to use the most persuasive narratives, whether they are in line with the facts or not, there is this huge asymmetry. And this asymmetry does seem to be larger and larger with the ease of accessing different narratives. So I think already in the present there is this asymmetry, and in the future with increasing ease, it is questionable whether the narratives that politicians say will be, you know, very much or have to be very much grounded in truth, and rather it might be a reasonable prediction that less and less truth will have a role to play in binding narratives down, unfortunately.
We have some tricky questions coming in online.
Can I pick up the third question that we got? Because actually I think it links to Adam's really important methodologies, which is that we hadn't until now had a way of capturing the granularity that is offered by what we might call qualitative data at scale. And I think what you're trying to do, I think, is do that by using precisely the technology that's actually contributing also to the saturation of our sort of info ecosystem with narratives. And so I think there's something really exciting there in terms of enabling a multitude of voices to be heard in a more rigorous and actually economical, and I mean that in a non-technical sense, way. So prior to that, we have had deliberative democracy, we have had citizens' councils. Ireland led the way on those with its abortion debate and the decision leading up to the referendum. But that takes a lot of time. and a lot of money and a lot of people volunteering to give up their time to come to these meetings and do it in person. There's something hugely valuable about that. I'm always about both and not either or. But if we can start using the kinds of tools that you're developing to get that granularity, to get those stories through and heard, maybe actually we can start to push back against this hyper-individualization and this morass of stories that we can't differentiate the truth or not of. So I think I don't think the future is all bleak. I think we're being offered via these technologies that are also causing massive problems, methodologies which can perhaps help us move forward in better ways as well.
Thank you. I'm going to bring in the invisible but very salient online audience, because here are three challenging questions, and I invite you each to comment on maybe one, but not all, so that we can also hear more from the audience. So Francesca Stuardo asks, what can we do about the fact that many narratives assume we're human and we share values? And how do we shape narratives for policy when extremely conservative narratives dehumanise? And I think the kind of the rise also of hateful narratives and dehumanising narratives is a good challenge to think about. A question from Isabel Santana Urbina. Can storytelling compensate for policy and governance deficits? Or does policy always require something deeper, more structural than just good storytelling? I think she's answered the question, but you might have something else to say. And Zaria Musgrove asks about historical and cultural differences in narratives. How do we contextualize different kinds of stories, different traditions of storytelling when doing policy making and giving this kind of weight to storytelling? These can be very culturally specific. So I think those are three great provocations, and then I'm going to come back to the room in the hope that we have time. Yeah.
Yeah, they are very, very good questions. Maybe I'll take the first one first. Which is about dehumanizing narratives and the power of dehumanizing narratives. And I'm not sure I have anything, maybe I have something slightly optimistic to say, but it is true that dehumanizing narratives have been extremely successful politically, not just now, but you know, in basically any time period. Mm. There's a rich history of dehumanizing narratives winning out, at least temporarily. But this temporality might be the silver lining. I do think, I mean, there is some cognitive research backing this up. Well, of course, cognitive research backs up that these dehumanizing narratives have some power, but it also backs up that in the end, humans usually do like to believe in a better world. So I think there is power, and there is scientific evidence that there is power in narratives which shape positive future, and I think, or which draw what this positive future could look like. And I think that's the only hopeful way to combat these dehumanizing narratives.
Mm. Stories can also dehumanize in really interesting ways. I was teaching yesterday Art Spiegelman's Mao, the graphic novel that perhaps raised comics to a serious art form. For those of you who don't know it, he interviewed his dad, who experienced the Holocaust, ended up in Auschwitz, and then in the States, and survived. And he tells it in graphic form. The Jewish people are represented as the mice, the Nazis are represented as cats, the Americans are represented as dogs. He's using actually an age-old form of children's storytelling, where human beings are represented as animals. And of course, we all know that a prime site of the dehumanizing narratives was Nazi rhetoric. Mm. So for Spiegelman to do that is a really interesting way of actually reappropriating at least the image of animals in a way that powerfully combats the dehumanization of some of the narratives that he's engaging with. So again, there a story offers a way of perhaps challenging some of that dehumanization. Mm-hmm. The other way it comes in is if we want really good narratives about AI, or if we're going to speculate artificial general intelligence, which has got a you know, a radically different form of intelligence to human beings, actually going to the history of stories about robots and machines isn't actually very helpful. But going to stories about alien intelligences, like the film Arrival and the short story, Ted Chiang's short story it's based on, absolutely fascinating explorations of how we might contend with, communicate with, engage with a form of intelligence that's radically different to our own. And that speaks to the human. Many, many stories do not assume either that they're storytellers or the people or sentient creatures that they're telling stories about are human. So I guess I'm trying to complicate that point a little bit.
Sharon, I think you told some stories. We told where stories undermine policymaking, and I think that's in a way what the question is. Or maybe stories can also compensate for government deficits. Can they get us over the? Or is that?
I mean, I think it goes a little bit, but I think to Adam's point about the medium term, I think ultimately storytelling without substantive policy. It doesn't work. All it does is create a bigger democratic deficit, which is, I mean, and this is why I'm in a similar place to you, that ultimately these things do have to come together. I think they can might take a generation, but ultimately rhetoric and narrative and storytelling without being able to get to a GP appointment on time, or my kid getting a decent education, or not cycling over potholes when I'm going to work, those things ultimately matter. And I mean, you can see this a little bit with, you know, what's happening in Hungary, that sort of, as soon as the delivery and the economy start to soften, actually you then have a very different debate about some of the stories and the dehumanisation that have felt as though they are unarguable with.
Yes, I hope you're going to tell us.
Well, I have to do the historical and cultural differences, don't I?
Go for it.
Well,
and you have to be optimistic.
Okay. All right.
I don't think that's.
Well, let me see if I can tie it into the hyper individualism as well. Let me talk about class differences, because that's what I'm more familiar with, which is a cultural difference, which is actually largely neglected in a lot of academic discourse. If you look at the mission statements of most universities, they are hyper-individualised. They're about personal growth, they're about personal development, it's about how I'm going to benefit personally from attending this institution. Very little around collaboration and community and connection, which are much more deeply embedded in working-class cultures. So there is a disconnect between what we signal as being important and we value in the kinds of narratives we use in public policy, and those narratives as they are lived and experienced on the ground. I just question the hyper-individual. Everything is about context, but one of the contexts that's, I think, important in a world that's becoming more virtually connected and hyper-individualised is our desire and craving for connection is ever increasing. Live sport attendance is up 4% year on year, consistently. Our willingness to pay to go to gigs, to festivals, is through the roof. So, yes, we may be in many of our worlds disconnected and hyper-individualised, but we crave connection. And so that's a perfect segue for me to tell you about my most recent collaborator. You know, obviously Danny is no longer with us, but some of you may be familiar with Fatboy Slim. And we've collaborated recently, and this will tie into storytelling, on an experiment recently. No, this is a really good story, I think.
Yeah.
Where we had, at two of his gigs that he played in Brighton, we had the whole crowd with heart rate monitors on, and heart rate variability monitors, including wearables and chest straps. And one of the things that we've been doing is looking for, it's the first time this has been done at scale, is to look for alignment between heart rates through the course of his 2-3 hour sets. And there seems to be a consistent pattern emerging, which is that we're essentially connected, or our heart rates become, our biomarkers become aligned in the moment before the drop. So for those of you that may not know what the drop is, in anticipation of the bass kicking in when everybody goes crazy. And that's important, I think, because we're showing connection in anticipation. And this ties directly into storytelling, I think, in a way that I hadn't previously thought about. I'd spent a lot of time in my academic life thinking about connection and about anticipation, but I hadn't made the connection between connection and anticipation. And it looks, if this, we're going to do other studies and other trials in other contexts, if this is true, that we are connected in essentially in imagination, in anticipation, rather than in the experience of the event itself, that becomes incredibly powerful for our understanding about how narratives and stories are imaginations, how they can provide us with the glue that brings us together. And that is a very optimistic point on which to finish my comment, isn't it, Charles? Thank you.
We have just under 10 minutes left, and I'm conscious there were more questions, so we may have more questions but than time for answers. But let's take the, I can see a couple of eager hands over on the far side of the room. If, yeah, thank you. One in the check shirt and one on the far against the wall. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, I'm Maria Bajkova. I'm a sixth form student, and I wanted to ask a question to Adam. So I wanted to ask, why are narratives changing in relation to climate change and the size of the government, and what can we do / learn about this as a society to make sure that we maybe have more power over the narrative, basically? Thank you.
Thank you, and also for being beautifully concise. And one more.
Hi, I'm Luca. I'm an LSE student. When the Oxford Council tried to implement certain policies using the narrative of the 15-minute city, that was met with people creating a different narrative, very opposing, based on misinformation, based on conspiracy theory. And as an answer to that, the city council then decided to drop the narrative of the 15-minute city. Not necessarily the policies connected to it, but the narratives. Do you think that can work? Do you think that practitioners can do policy without narratives in order to depoliticize it? Mm.
Good one. And a couple over here, maybe. Tell me if I'm pushing my luck here. One right at the back behind you, if you'd be. Thank you.
Hello, my name's Prophet. I'm a student at LSE studying inequality. I'm a bit concerned about the use of AI, particularly in trying to bring marginalized voices into a common political space when the largest AI tools and platforms are currently shaped by algorithms constructed by human owners who in the current field are contributing to rapid polarization, concentration of wealth and inequality, and have also openly espoused racist and views and harmful ideological standpoints. And sorry, I know time is short, but just to quickly add on as well that recently it was shown through reporting that Anthropic's Claude was also assisting the US in invading Venezuela and capturing their leader, that Palantir and Microsoft AI tools are helping facilitate ethnic cleansing and genocide. So I'm just wondering why we keep on pushing the use of AI when we know these things are taking place.
Thank you. I'm going to pass to Adam first. I think there was some...
Yeah, good luck, Adam. We're all listening.
Yes. I'm afraid that's not
AI, but also about climate change.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm afraid that's not a very simple question to answer, why the narratives are changing and what to do about it as a society. Mm. But I can say some things about this based on our research. So the first thing, and maybe it's obvious, but I think it has to be stated clearly, is that there is a disconnect between climate science and the evidence versus what politicians say about climate policy. So understanding that disconnect is really important, because we cannot just bet on the fact that if scientific evidence points us towards some direction, then policy will follow. So there is this disconnect. Now the question is, so why is there this disconnect? And why is it driving climate narratives in the opposite direction to what science says? And this goes back to my previous point about incentives and the asymmetry of incentives. So because of the fact that politicians really care about their narratives because it's their bread and butter, whereas voters often might not pay very close attention to data because it's very, very hard to do so on many complex issues, including the issue of climate policy. What seems to be happening is that politicians often hide trade-offs when talking about policy. Yeah. So instead of saying, for instance, climate policy is needed in order to address climate change, but it might be costly for the economy, instead of saying this, which is a narrative that you do sometimes hear, but mostly not, what you hear instead is either the narrative that climate policy is really important and it will generate amazing jobs and everybody will be extremely happy, or that climate change is a hoax and climate policy would be terrible for the economy. So these are sort of the what we call entangled narratives that you hear that hide trade-offs. And because of this narrative entanglement, what happens is that if, for whatever reason, it becomes harder to be a proponent of climate policy, potentially just because gas prices have been rising, energy prices have been rising, as a politician who might not be comfortable talking about trade-offs, you won't just say that, you know, it's still important to do climate policy, but it's now a bit more expensive, perhaps, or harder. Instead, you might fall silent on the topic, or indeed say, actually, don't worry about it, we have done enough. So I think understanding these incentives of politicians to sometimes hide trade-offs and why they might get away with it sometimes, especially if voters don't look closely at the data, can explain this disconnect between where the evidence is moving and what politicians are saying.
Well, I was just going to say, if you want three narrative models that show how that works, there's Herzog's Heat, which was published in the late 1970s, which is it's a pulp novel, so it ends up with, you know, climbing around a globe and burning. But if you look at it, it's absolutely brilliant on the disconnect between scientific evidence and political decision making. So is Michael Crichton's State of Fear, which is often demonized because it is a sort of climate denial novel. But one of the things he does brilliantly is model the relationship between climate science, political decision making. As does the more contemporary film Don't Look Up, which is essentially about an asteroid strike, but it's an analogy for climate change. And again, in a very satirical mode, demonstrates those trade-offs. What are the politicians actually factoring in when they're making these decisions, as well as the scientist who's spent, you know, 7 hours sitting outside their office to say their piece. So the history of fiction, as we might call it, has explored this in detail since the very earliest evidence of anthropogenic climate change in the late 70s.
Sharon, I feel you must see lots of circumstances where there are contrasting and polarised narratives. One narrative is answered by another, which cancels it out. I'm not describing your life in the House of Lords, but... or
everybody's very polite at the House of Lords.
But how do we get past that? The kind of the war of the narratives...
I mean, I do think discussions like this are really important. We haven't had a conversation this evening about the incentives to go into policy making, the incentives to go into politics, which I think it's got a much harder job, and I think you can see that in all sorts of avenues and where the state is at the moment. Mm. So for me, I think the question about incentives that we've touched on in many different sort of parts of the conversation this evening is really important. And then actually, how do we have, and it's a really rare skill to be able to bring together sort of public appeal, substantive ideas, and a desire to support the majority of a population. Mm. Let's make it easier to get into politics.
Paul, I'm going to give you the last word because we are, I think, at our time, and you've edited the special issue. Did it answer all the questions you started with?
Of course, and there were some super questions. I mean, the role of AI and polarities. I mean, it's just would be glib to try to answer that question in like 5 seconds. But what I will do in 10 seconds is say I think someone who does research on essentially happiness and tolerance is that agentic AI is probably going to be a good personal assistant to help make you happier. It's probably not going to be a very good personal assistant to make you more tolerant, because you're not going to want to listen to alternative views, and it will continue to serve you in ways that are self-fulfilling and self-perpetuating. So that's a point. But we can have a longer conversation at other times, of course, with LSE and elsewhere. I just love the fact that that everybody's here at 8 o'clock, and those that are online, why aren't you? And also to thank everybody, and to thank again Irene and Tim and everybody who has been incredibly supportive in this special issue and in this narratives in policy.
And I think listening has been a theme running through quite a number of the contributions here, and you've been fabulous listeners as well as asking questions. Can we thank our panel very much?
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.